Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Siegfried Hecker, visiting professor at Stanford University and director emeritus of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and your chair for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for tonight, Ambassador Linton F. Brooks. Ambassador Brooks is Undersecretary of Energy for Nuclear Security and Administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration, typically referred to as NNSA. As such, he's the chief steward of the nation's nuclear weapons program, having the responsibility for the nuclear weapons complex, ranging from the weapons production disassembly sites to the research and the design laboratories at Los Alamos, Livermore, and the Sandia National Laboratories. His primary responsibility today is to keep the nuclear weapons in the U.S. stockpile safe, secure, and reliable without nuclear testing. I think you'll agree that that's a heavy burden indeed. If that were not enough, the NNSA also is the nation's primary organization that deals with nuclear arms control, nonproliferation, and nuclear terrorism. In other words, he has to deal with the nuclear hotspots around the globe, such as Iran and North Korea, assess the proliferation challenges from a nuclear India and a nuclear Pakistan, and look ahead as to how to prevent another cycle of proliferation. And he must deal with what I consider the most urgent challenge today, that is how to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists. It is the challenges of nonproliferation in today's nuclear world that he will address tonight. He's eminently qualified to do so. Nuclear weapons and arms control have been at the center of his career for over four decades. I've known him as one of the most knowledgeable and thoughtful scholars in this area. He began his career as a naval officer, which included being deployed on nuclear-equipped ships. He served in the Pentagon, in the White House, on the National Security Council, in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and in the State Department, where he headed the U.S. delegation to the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, namely START 1, and played a seminal role in START 2. And prior to his current responsibility, he was Deputy Administrator for Defense Nuclear Nonproliferation at the Department of Energy and the NNSA. Ambassador Brooks holds a B.S. in Physics from Duke University and an M.A. in Government and Politics from the University of Maryland. Please help me welcome Ambassador Linton Brooks to talk about the challenges of nonproliferation in today's nuclear world.
Well, thank you very much, Sig. It's a particular honor for me to address an organization which, for over a century, has been identified with the thoughtful consideration of important issues of public policy. Tonight, what I'd like to do is talk, as Sig said, about the challenges of nonproliferation in today's world, a world in which nuclear terrorism is, it appears to me, a real and perhaps growing concern. Now, there's a good deal of attention focused on Iran and North Korea, and that's obviously correct. Their determination to isolate themselves from the international community by seeking nuclear weapons is regrettable, and it must be dealt with, and it will be dealt with. The President, the administration are devoting efforts toward resolving these issues, but in many ways, the threat from Iran and North Korea pales compared to the threat from nuclear terrorism, as Dr. Hecker suggested. The overwhelming military power of the United States, including its nuclear capabilities, means that even a nuclear-armed rogue state would be hesitant to attack us, our allies, or our interests for fear of the inevitable devastating retaliation. Now, in contrast, terrorist groups are more difficult to deter because they lack a fixed asset that you can threaten to retaliate against. We don't believe, and I want to make it very clear, I do not believe, and I do not believe the administration thinks, that any terrorist group now is able to launch any kind of nuclear attack against the United States. But I do think there's very strong evidence that terrorists would like to acquire that capability, and if they did, they would have no inhibitions whatsoever against using it. Now, that's not just my view. At the St. Petersburg summit, the leaders of the G8 said the following: the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, together with international terrorism, remain the preeminent threat to international peace and security. The international community must, therefore, act decisively to tackle this threat. We reaffirm our determination and commitment to work together in the fight against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, including preventing them from falling into the hands of terrorists. That's the latest in a long series of statements that you've heard from various world leaders about the importance of the threat. And since the very earliest days of this administration, the president has recognized that threat. Under his leadership, the United States has used established diplomatic organizations like the United Nations, leading, for example, the Security Council Resolution 1540, which requires states to establish legal mechanisms to inhibit proliferation. We've worked to strengthen existing regimes, for example, by taking the lead in creating the Committee on Safeguards and Verification and the Atomic Energy Agency. We've worked to ensure voluntary cooperation through efforts such as the Proliferation Security Initiative and the initiative President Bush and President Putin announced this past Saturday, a global initiative against nuclear terrorism. We've worked bilaterally in quiet efforts that have led, for example, to Libya giving up after a very long time its nuclear ambitions. And when necessary, the president's been willing to act alone. And so I think that that leadership and determination and flexibility are part of our approach. Now, from the very beginning, there's been one mantra that we repeat, and that is keeping the world's most dangerous materials out of the hands of the world's most dangerous people. And this fight against nuclear terrorism is integrally related to traditional nonproliferation, and it was, of course, given new impetus by the attacks of September 11th, 2001. The Department of Energy and my part of it are playing a particularly leading role, as Sig suggested, in this. And so we're two-thirds of the way through the administration. I want to tell you what we've done, what's left to do, and then in the question period we can argue about what else we should have done. First, a lot of our emphasis has been focused on Russia. It's been focused on Russia because that's where the greatest amount of poorly secured nuclear material was when we took office. We're working on a number of fronts with Russia, and we've made quite good progress. This year, we will complete improving the security of Russian Navy weapons and nuclear fuel, a full 2 years ahead of the schedule we inherited. By the end of 2008, we'll complete security upgrades throughout the far-flung establishment of the Russian Federal Agency for Atomic Energy, which is our rough nuclear counterpart. Last year, the United States and Russia agreed to a list of military sites where we would jointly work to upgrade security, and we'll finish those upgrades by the end of 2008 as well. When they met last year, President Bush and President Putin issued a joint statement on nuclear security, often called the Bratislava Statement, because the meeting was held in Bratislava in the Slovak Republic. And it called for enhanced nuclear security cooperation in emergency response, in sharing information on best practices in security culture, in material protection and control, and in research reactors. And it's an illustration of a movement from assistance to partnership. And the United States began its efforts with the Russian Federation in the 90s. Russia was economically destitute. And if security improvements were going to be made, they were going to have to be funded by somebody else. And the United States has provided that funding. We're now moving into a phase where what we want to do is share best practices and then export those best practices to other countries. And what's important about the Bratislava statement is not the details. Details are useful to me. But what's important is the fact that it indicates that the upper echelons of the Russian government appreciate the gravity of nuclear security. And we saw a reaffirmation of that at the St. Petersburg meeting this past weekend. Now, Russia isn't the only place with material that could be used for nuclear weapons. We've also worked to improve security throughout the former Soviet Union. One area of particular concern is research reactors. And at first you may say, why do you care about research reactors? Because many research reactors use highly enriched uranium. That is to say, uranium of the same character that you use for nuclear weapons. But many research reactors are located in academic institutions where you don't have the kind of security that you think of as associated with nuclear facilities or nuclear weapons. And so what we are trying to do is take these reactors and help the states involved convert them to use a lower enriched uranium that does not pose proliferation risks, and then to repatriate to either the United States or Russia the both spent and fresh fuel. As it turns out, almost all of these reactors originally came from either the United States or Russia. We're also working to reduce the risk of threat of theft in other areas. But every system depends on people. Greed, coercion, debt provide powerful opportunities for facility insiders to decide that they want to circumvent all of this. And because there are a large number of nuclear facilities and each of them is different, the problem is compounded. So our cooperation is much beyond improving physical security. We are putting in places systems to help ensure personnel reliability. We have a very long and generally successful set of programs in the United States to make sure the people who work in and around nuclear material and nuclear weapons are reliable. And we're trying to share that experience with the Russian Federation. We're exchanging best practices in security with a number of countries, most definitely including Russia. And finally, we are encouraging both publicly and privately the Russian Federation and others to commit the necessary resources. At the end of the day, we can help the Russians, we can help other states improve security, but the maintenance of that improved security is inherently their responsibility. And so we're working to help them understand how to maintain security over the long run and, to the extent that they don't understand it, why it's so important. Now, if everything I said worked perfectly, we'd go to questions now. But we can't be sure that it does. The best way to secure nuclear materials is at the source. But because we can't be sure about the human factor, we have to hold out the possibility that material may be stolen, and even worse, that it may be stolen and we would be unaware of it. I will submit to you that can't happen in the United States. I'm very confident in the security that we have. It is increasingly hard for it to happen elsewhere, but you can't be sure. And so, as a natural complement, we've used what we call a second line of defense, the first line being security at the source. And that works with international partners to help prevent the movement of nuclear and radiological material across borders. So we take high-risk border crossing, seaports, airports, and install detection systems. To further broaden it, we established in 2003 a program called Megaports. And Megaports is a program to look at the very large number of ports which ship material to the United States. Because I'd like this material to stay locked up where it belongs. And if I can't do that, I'd like it not to get out of the country where it started. But my responsibility is security of the United States. So if it does get out of the country where it started, I'd like it not to get here. And so with the Megaports program, we are installing detectors that can process these very large containers that are the way international trade goes without disrupting trade. I mean, everybody knows how to take a container about and inspect it and bring international trade to a standstill. Question is, what can we do with technology to verify that smuggling is not going on? This is a three-year-old program. We have now systems operational in the Netherlands, Greece, Spain, Singapore, Sri Lanka, and the Bahamas. We're talking now in various stages at 15 additional ports within 11 countries and Taiwan. And we're aggressively talking to about 20 other countries. And we parallel this effort with a similar effort by the Department of Homeland Security called the Container Security Initiative. And that's part of our overall strategy to make sure that we use a series of layers to prevent dangerous material, ideally from getting in the wrong hands, but also from getting here. Now, that sounds fine, but it doesn't really solve all of the problems. There is simply too much nuclear material in the world. There is enough highly enriched uranium and weapons-usable plutonium in the world for tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. So just like when you're in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging, an integral part of our strategy has been to stop making materials globally. As the United States hasn't made plutonium or highly enriched uranium for weapons purposes for a very long time, 20 years or so. We've tabled a treaty, fissile material cutoff treaty, but here as elsewhere, we're supplementing our diplomatic efforts with bilateral programs. An example, Russia still makes weapons plutonium. Russia still makes weapons plutonium because the reactors that make it also furnish heat and light for cities in the middle of the country. So we are working with them to provide alternate means of getting that heat and light so that they can shut down irrevocably these facilities. When the administration leaves, two of the existing three plutonium production reactors in Russia will have been shut down forever, and the third one will be scheduled for shutdown in 2010. What about new material from enrichment or reprocessing? We have to worry about that because under the guise of peaceful uses, there is a risk that countries will develop a capability. That's what the fight in Iran is about. The issue in Iran is an assertion on their part, which for reasons we can go into in the question period, we tend to disagree, that they're just doing something for peaceful purposes. Well, if you want to take away that argument, then you have to give an alternative that still gives states the benefit of nuclear power. So in 2004, the president proposed a new international regime where nations would have no need to develop new capability to enrich or reprocess nuclear fuel, but they'd still have the assured benefits of nuclear power. The president expanded that earlier this year with what's called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which, although very long range, holds out the possibility of a future of environmentally clean nuclear energy, far less nuclear waste to dispose of, and extremely strong safeguards against proliferation. We also need, obviously, to deal with the material that already exists. We're trying to set an example by recycling substantial quantities of highly enriched uranium. We downblend much material to the lower enrichments suitable for commercial reactors. Just last month, we made our 200th shipment of low-enriched uranium for fabrication and commercial nuclear fuel for Tennessee Valley Authority reactors. We're working with Russia to take their weapons uranium and downblend it. There's a program that has the colloquial name of megatons to megawatts. It takes Russian highly enriched uranium from Soviet-era nuclear weapons. I do some monitoring to verify that that uranium is, I don't want to use too strong a word, because is suitable for weapons. You can't prove that it actually came out of weapons, but suitable for weapons. They blend it down to low-enriched uranium. They sell it to commercial reactor operators in the United States. Now, nuclear power generates 20% of the electricity in the United States, and half of that is powered by uranium that comes from this program. Another way of saying that is 1 out of 10 light bulbs in the United States is powered by former Soviet atom bombs. We've also tried to get rid of plutonium, which is the others. You know, there are two ways you make a nuclear weapon: highly enriched uranium and plutonium. We have an agreement with the Russian Federation to eliminate 34 metric tons of plutonium each. We'll do ours by converting it into a particular fuel form called mixed oxide fuel. We'll do that at a plant that we hope to begin construction on in September of this year. Our Russian counterparts are reevaluating their technical approach, but they remain committed to disposing of this material. They will start in a much smaller way, but actually start sooner than we, by burning it in some existing fast reactors. Finally, if I don't delay, if I don't stop making enough material, if I don't eliminate material, if I don't guard enough material, if someone actually gets material into the United States, we work with the Department of Homeland Security maintaining nuclear emergency search teams. Some of you will have seen press stories of an exercise called Top Off, in which we practiced the command and control and coordination necessarily if there were an improvised nuclear device, and actually what we would do with it, where we would move it. And these teams work closely with the Department of Defense, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security. Now, this is an area we're trying to build international cooperation as well. Under Bratislava, we've initiated a nuclear emergency dialogue with Russia. Through 2 years of interactions, we've had participation in exercises held in both countries, and we're starting to understand one another's approach, and we're starting to benefit from an exchange of information. It's a very low-key effort. I've actually been pleased, and I guess to be candid, a little surprised at the seriousness and openness with which the Russians have approached this effort. Now, we focus on material because that's the one absolute certainty. People may or may not have enough information or be able to gain enough information to fashion a crude nuclear device, but they can't do it without either highly enriched uranium or plutonium. But I don't want to suggest that all we do is worry about protecting material. What A.Q. Khan, who masterminded an international network primarily focused on enrichment services, tells us is that we have to use all the tools to prevent the diffusion of critical technologies. So we're using UN Security Council resolution as a lever to encourage states to strengthen export control laws. We have regular dialogue with about 70 states on export control, and we're gradually working to strengthen these regimes in the nuclear area worldwide. We're engaging research institutes and industry and government in about 40 countries to try and identify technologies that is important. Now, in each of these, I would assert, U.S. leadership is helping to make the nation safer and the world safer. We are, by definition, the world's leader, and therefore we have to set the example. So what have we done to set the example? Well, first of all, we've dramatically improved security of our own nuclear materials throughout the Department of Energy in the aftermath of 9/11. We don't talk about specific details, but let me just say that terrorists who try to get nuclear materials from us are suicide terrorists, whether they know it or not. So we've done that. We've announced reductions in our own stockpile, which, when they are completed in 2012, will result in the smallest U.S. stockpile since the Eisenhower administration. Sig mentioned that I had been around for a very long time. I was commissioned in the last year of the Eisenhower administration. So that's another way of saying the smallest stockpile in my professional lifetime. We're trying to transform our weapons complex to make it more flexible, and if we're successful in doing that, I think that we will be able to do still further reductions in the coming years, consistent with the president's long-stated vision of the smallest stockpile consistent with our national security. We ended enrichment of uranium and production of plutonium years ago. We've taken recently, because of the reductions that the president announced, we were able to withdraw from weapons use 200 tons of highly enriched uranium. Some of that will power our nuclear submarine fleet for the next 50 years, meaning that we will not be faced with the question of enriching for any military purposes during that time. 17 tons of it will be blended down and will be used as a fuel supply of last resort. Remember, I mentioned the president's proposals to provide the benefits of nuclear energy to states without them having to create their own fuel cycle. Well, what we seek is to have a regime in which there are multiple suppliers of nuclear fuel so states can't fear that they'll be cut off. Our record, I believe, is broad and impressive, and we're proud of it, and you should be too. There's no responsibility of government that's more important than preserving security and freedom. And keeping our country safe from nuclear terrorism requires the building of strong international bonds, not just with governments, but with police forces, border guards, research institutes. We're building those bonds. Keeping our country safe from nuclear terrorism requires sustained, dedicated effort by devoted civil servants and laboratory scientists and leaders. We have an exceptional group of men. If you disagree with everything I've said, and disagree with everything this administration does, you should still be proud of the men and women of both our laboratories and our federal service who are working very hard to contain this threat. They're doing a wonderful job. Keeping our country safe from nuclear terrorism requires strong support from Congress. In an era of acrimony, it is striking the very strong, broad, bipartisan support we have had from Congress for essentially all of the programs that I have described. It's been a welcome oasis in a somewhat tense time. And obviously, keeping our country safe from terrorism requires strong, determined leadership. And from the president on down, we're trying to provide that leadership. We're trying to cooperate, to respect international agreements, to use technology creatively. In short, we're trying to use all the instruments of national power. In a statement following their meeting last Friday, President Bush and President Putin said, "Through our cooperation in the field of nuclear nonproliferation, we seek to improve the security of our own peoples and of all others in the world community." This statement, it seems to me, makes two things clear. First, as Dr. Hecker suggested in his opening remarks, this may be the most important national security issue facing us. And secondly, it is an issue where the world either succeeds together or fails together. We're determined that the threat of nuclear terrorism never becomes a reality, either here or abroad. We don't intend to fail. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Our thanks to Ambassador Linton Brooks, Administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration. Again, I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm going to start moderating the Q&A period right now. So, Ambassador Brooks, if you would stay there. We have actually a very large number of questions. And I wonder if you would mind, if there's an occasional question, might I bring in Dr. Hecker?
Sure.
Okay. Just too good an opportunity to have both of you here to resist. Someone in the audience has clearly read Joe Nye's book, Soft Power, and asks the question, which is the more effective means of enforcing nonproliferation cooperation, hard or soft power? Most of what you talked about and the strategies you're talking about would be classed as soft power, diplomacy, collaboration, stockpile security, and so on. Their hard power is typically thought of as military power. And I just like to extend the question, are there hard power options when it comes to proliferation, as in Dr. Perry's recent suggestion that we take out a missile test site in North Korea? So what's the range, soft power to hard power? Is there a role for hard power?
Well, if I'm right that this is the most important security issue facing us, then it would be irresponsible to ignore any element of national power. I focused on what you call soft power because that's my part of the shop. But obviously, ascending up the scale, the condemnation of the international community and the imposition of sanctions is something that, as you know, the United States has advocated in the case of North Korea and Iran. I think military options are always available and never get better by being discussed, and so we generally don't. With regard to Ash and Bill Perry's suggestion about striking the Taepodong, they wanted to destroy it. The North Koreans managed to do that in 20 seconds, and we didn't have to spend any money. So I think we did not believe that that was the appropriate use, but I think it is a measure of the frustration of serious Americans with the continued intransigence of the North Korean regime.
Any comment on those of you who don't know, the former Secretary of Defense wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post suggesting that we take out the test site in North Korea prior to that test that occurred on the 4th of July. So it stirred a lot of debate in this field. You mentioned the smallest stockpile consistent with our national security.
Yep.
Someone would like you to quantify that. How big is the smallest stockpile?
Okay, there are two elements of that. One is, what do you deploy? The United States right now is moving toward having between 1,700 and 2,200 operationally deployed warheads by 2012. Whether that's the right number is fundamentally a question for the Department of Defense. My own view is that 10 years from now, it will not be the number that we do. The number will be lower. But that stockpile is backed up by a quite large stockpile of non-deployed weapons. Some of that is inevitable. I mean, if you have cars, you have parts for them that aren't deployed. And so there's a certain amount of logistics repairs. But most of the non-deployed stockpile is a hedge. It's a hedge against failure. So, for example, we keep two different warheads for our ICBMs so that if we find a problem with one, we can deploy some of the others. And it's a hedge against what is euphemistically called geopolitical change, which is another way of saying somebody decides that an arms race might be an interesting option. That part, if we are successful in making our weapons complex more responsive, I believe can be reduced dramatically. And so I think that we will see a much smaller stockpile. This is not an area where we traditionally talk numbers, and I'm probably not going to break that tradition now. My guess is that there's probably some reduction in the deployed stockpile, and there's a very considerable reduction in the non-deployed stockpile that's possible and desirable within the next 6, 7, 8 years.
Can you talk generally about how the U.S. upgrades its weapon systems and destroys outmoded weaponry, particularly given that we don't test in the case of upgrading weapon systems?
Well, the approach until a little while ago has been what's called life extension, which is sort of build it over the way it was built the first time as components wear out. That's a perfectly reasonable strategy. But what it means is that you forego any of the benefits of more modern approaches to safety and security. It means that you live with the drawbacks of some of the exotic materials that we used during the Cold War, like beryllium, which modern environmental and health standards make a particularly difficult material to deal with. And so our approach, and finally it means that as you get farther and farther away from testing, you run the risk, I'll phrase this very carefully because there's no evidence that we are there yet, you run the risk that someday these careful annual assessments will not suggest that we have high confidence that the weapons will function as designed. And then you put the president in a terribly difficult question, does he resume testing something which would have huge political implications and will inherently be called for in an ambiguous way? I mean, it's not that all of a sudden a light will light up and say, if you don't test this weapon tomorrow, the sky will end. So what we want to do is get out of that conundrum. And the idea right now is a thing called the reliable replacement warhead. It's a concept which we're busy turning into a design. We've got a design competition between the two design labs that we will look at in December. And the idea of this is to sit back and say, if we were taking the weapons we have now and building them today, what would we do differently? And I want to stress, talking about weapons carried by the same delivery systems, same military characteristics, same targets. So this is not a question of improving the military efficacy of the weapon. This is a question of improving safety, security, and reliability. Well, what would we do? Well, if you look back at the Cold War, what did we do? We said we want to be able to put the largest number of weapons on a missile you can. So that means that individually they have to be as light as you can get, but still have some significant yield. Second thing we said was, boy, plutonium, very scarce resource. We have to minimize the use of plutonium. And so we designed weapons that were very close to various performance margins. That was a sensible decision in the Cold War. It is not a sensible decision now. We've got the same missile, but now we put far fewer warheads on it, so who cares if an individual warhead is a little bit heavier? And we got plutonium coming out of our ears. I just told you I'm trying to get rid of 34 tons of plutonium. So the idea is if we can remanufacture, redesign these warheads, we can do several things. We can improve the design margin so that we are less sensitive to the aspects of aging and thus significantly reduce the chance of testing. We can put in some kind of very interesting modern safety and security features, which that's everything I'm going to say about those features, but they will provide substantially increased safety and particularly security at the warhead itself. and we can make the manufacturing process much easier. It is, Dr. Hecker will not completely agree with this characterization, but it is not unfair to say that our weapons lab designed these really sophisticated things and then handed them to the production complex and said, go make this. And now what we're trying to do is involve the production complex. And the benefit of that is that it means that any kind of rework I have to do, I can do quickly, which means I don't need to maintain spares. So our approach is to try to improve the weapons so that we can improve the complex and make it more responsive, so that we can both have safety, security, and reliability, which are, I would submit to you, intrinsic goods. If you can have weapons at all, you want them to be safe, secure, and reliable. So we can also put our flexibility and our response to change into the infrastructure and thus reduce the number of aging weapons that we're hanging on to as hedges.
And I'm going to pass it to Sig Hecker, Director Emeritus of Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Well, let me just make a few comments to underscore what Ambassador Brooks said. First of all, I think the question is a very good and important question, the asking of what are we doing to upgrade the nuclear weapons today without testing. And as Ambassador Brooks explained, the upgrading is really all in trying to maintain the reliability. And so the issue is one that back in 1992, President Bush the elder made the decision that we would not develop new nuclear weapons with new capabilities. And so the program that we designed when I was at Los Alamos as director was we called the stewardship of nuclear weapons. And it meant exactly that, that as long, I felt from a technical standpoint, our responsibilities were that as long as this country decides it must have nuclear weapons, then it was our responsibility to make sure that they would work and they would be safe and reliable. And the without testing part, it turns out, really is quite an enormous challenge, because all the exotic materials you have in a nuclear weapon, particularly the plutonium, which I happen to be very interested in from a professional standpoint, it not only ages and rusts the way that iron does, but it actually bombards itself from the inside because it is radioactive. And so we've had the challenge to do precisely what Ambassador Brooks said. And so far, I think the complex and the technical people have done a very good job of keeping that stockpile safe, secure, and reliable. The question is, how much longer can we do that? And I view this reliable replacement warhead as a program that looks at the future, no new military characteristics, but just to make sure that 10 or 20 or whatever number of years that we need the weapons, that we, the technical people, can actually give the same sort of guarantees that we did before.
This, by the way, is a program that, once again, I've been very pleased at the general support from both sides of the aisle. Because I think the importance of safety, security, and reliability is hard to argue with, and so we have been very pleased with the reaction of Congress to this. And, you know, at a time when nuclear weapons are inherently contentious at any time, they're particularly contentious now, I think, given the sort of sharp polarization on many national security issues. And so it's been very gratifying the degree to which this has garnered pretty general support.
A couple of questions about Russia, and then I'll try to focus us in on Iran and North Korea, since those are the topics of much concern right now. Do the U.S. and Russia still have nuclear weapons aimed at each other?
That's a more complicated answer than you'd think. Here's the, I want to say, party line. This is true. It is not complete. It is true that the United States and Russia agreed some time ago to an approach called detargeting. The approach means that there are no targets in guidance systems as there were during the Cold War. And therefore, in that sense, there are no missiles on either side. I'm positive on our side. We have been told on theirs that are aimed at each other. It is also true that that is a largely reversible act and that one would not know whether it was being reversed. So the right way to think about it is we've taken the symbolic step of making it clear that we no longer think we need to threaten one another with an instant retaliation, but that it would be misleading to say that that's not a reversible step, because both systems are so designed that it is relatively brief period. I mean, I don't want to get into relatively brief. I don't mean minutes, but I certainly don't mean weeks.
Why is it a good idea to ship our spent reactor fuel to Russia?
It's not, and that's why we're not going to do it. It's not only not a good idea, it's also against the law. There's been some confusion in some of the public accounts. We are beginning discussions with Russia on the possibility of an agreement for nuclear cooperation under the Atomic Energy Act. It's Article 123, so it's called a 123 agreement. That agreement will primarily allow us to cooperate in the development of the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. It also would allow, but not require, a decision to allow some fuel that originated from the United States, mostly in South Korea and Taiwan, to be sent to Russia for storage and perhaps ultimately reprocessing. But that's what's called U.S. consent rights. They are not allowed to ship the fuel to a third country without our agreement. Our agreement would require this agreement between the Russian Federation. There's no interest in the United States in shipping spent fuel to Russia, no interest in Russia in accepting spent fuel, and I'm pretty sure the laws of both countries would have a problem. That's simply a garble that found its way into the press and we haven't been able to clarify yet.
Let's move to Iran. First, on basics, how close is Iran to a nuclear weapon? How good is our monitoring of this?
We don't know. Here's what we know. We know that the Iranians are taking a number of steps to develop the ability to enrich material. We know that they concealed a number of those steps from the International Atomic Energy Agency, that they are a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We know that every economic analysis shows that this does not appear to be an economically sensible decision. We know that they have been offered a guarantee of fuel for the reactors that they say they want to build from the Russian Federation. We know that they're sitting on a sea of oil, although they say that their philosophy is they'll sell that, and that's why they want to use nuclear for domestic. You put all those together, it is very difficult to convince yourself that the Iranian program is an energy program, or at least that it's only an energy program. And we know a little more that I'm not going to share with you that reinforces the view that this is about the ability to develop nuclear weapons. We also know that developing a enrichment capability in significant quantity is technically difficult. And I think that there are varying opinions, all of them denominated in years, about when Iran could have that capability. The reason we have a sense of urgency now is that we believe that once Iran fully understands the capability and the ability to enrich material in appropriate cascades, they have crossed a bridge that we essentially can't uncross. You can't put knowledge back in the bottle. So the idea is to try to convince the government of Iran to respond to international attempts to allow Iran to have the benefit of nuclear energy without developing its own fuel cycle. And I'm hoping that the government of Iran will be responsive.
Whoever they may be.
Whoever they may be.
Let me pass this to Dr. Hecker.
I would just like to add a couple of comments. I agree with Ambassador Brooks that at this point, no one outside of Iran really knows exactly where they stand. But I'd like to go a bit farther than he did in terms of what it looks like based on just open source information. And that is, the signature is just so clear. They're doing much more than just developing the enrichment capabilities for nuclear reactor fuel. And that is, if you actually look back in the 90s and you watch where they went shopping and whom they interacted with, it was clear they were going both for the capabilities for enriching uranium, and actually they're also in the process of building a reactor, the type of reactor that's very good in making weapons-grade plutonium. So it actually looks like they're exploring both paths. Both paths lead to a possible bomb. And so from my standpoint, at least on the basis of what I've seen, it's pretty clear that Iran is very interested. I'm not so concerned about the economic analysis because, quite frankly, the nuclear stuff, particularly here, as you look at Iran or North Korea, the economic analysis doesn't really mean much. But it also allows me to say just one more thing related to the issue of nuclear terrorism, and that being, in my opinion, the principal concern. To me, the greatest concern of Iran getting to the point where they cross the nuclear threshold is Iran getting nuclear materials. And then I would worry about the security of that material in Iran, where it would have such a short distance to go between the government and terrorist organizations. Whereas Iran may not use a nuclear weapon, if that nuclear material gets into the hands of terrorists, we have a problem. And for that reason, for me, Iran is really one of the key issues that we face today.
I don't disagree with anything Dr. Hecker said. It is a very, very significant problem.
Moving to North Korea, what do you believe the North Koreans are up to? Have they really deviated from a path that they're on for any reason over the last 5 years or so, no matter how many multi-party discussions, how many threats? Haven't they simply walked down the road towards the warheads, the missiles, testing the missiles?
Well, 100% of the technically literate Americans who've actually been to North Korea and talked about this subject are sitting at the table with you, and so you will want to hear Dr. Hecker's view on this. My own view is that there's been an attempt for a very long time to develop nuclear capability in North Korea. It's been associated with Kim Jong-il for a very long time. I see no evidence other than tactical retreats that they have changed that. On the other hand, while the dear leader has a value system that most of us would find strange, he is not, by his own terms, irrational. And I believe that it is not outside of the realm of possibility that continued strong international pressure, represented most recently by the United Nations resolution of, I think, Friday, will convince him that he is dealing not with the United States, not with the six-party talks, but with the entire international community, and he will decide that that price is too high. And I think that you just have to keep pushing that. I don't see any evidence that he has made that decision yet. I think that it's fairly clear that he has not, but we keep working it.
As Mr. Brooks indicated, Dr. Hecker has actually visited North Korea, visited nuclear facilities in North Korea. Do you see any actions by outside forces that would divert North Korea from its present course?
I did have the opportunity to go to North Korea, and if I could just very briefly sort of state the state of play in North Korea. Unlike in Iran, we do know some things very definitely, and that is we know they've cooked up a lot of plutonium in their reactor on the order of 40 to 50 kilograms. We think that they've extracted most of that plutonium to make it weapons usable. We do not know whether they've actually built nuclear weapons, but we must assume, particularly based on the technological capabilities I saw, that they know how to build a nuclear weapon, at least of the primitive type of a Nagasaki, for example. We don't know whether they can do it in a sophisticated way to mount it on a missile. And judging from the most recent experience, it would be a little tricky to put a nuclear weapon on those missiles that tend to blow up. But nevertheless, that threat is there. And I would answer the question by saying my biggest concern, again, about North Korea, not that they would mount a nuclear weapon on a missile and shoot it someplace, but again, it's the material. It's the plutonium. It's that 40 to 50 kilograms of plutonium. If that finds its way out of North Korea into the hands of terrorists, they will have a capability to deliver that in some fashion. And so the only way that I see out of this box is we have this enormously complicated political situation with a country that we don't deal with directly. I see that we have to set the priorities to say it's the plutonium that's of concern. If we focus on that and try to reduce the concern from the plutonium and for the time being put the other things sort of on the shelf, that might be a way to go. But, of course, that's a very difficult process. I think that has to be done within the confines of the six-party talks in conjunction with bilateral discussions of the U.S. and China with North Korea to see what can be done to secure the plutonium.
I certainly agree with Dr. Hecker on the risk of materials leaving. And I think that there is strong evidence of illicit dealing by the government of North Korea and other areas. And so I think that one has to worry about it leaving not because of lack of security, but because of deliberate decisions by the regime. The focus on plutonium, of course, is what we've been trying to do since the agreed framework of 1994, and it's not entirely clear that strategy has not yet succeeded. While the North Koreans were asserting that they were working toward that strategy, they appear to have been busy creating a second string to their bow through trying to develop a uranium enrichment program, although the details on that are much less clear than plutonium. So I think that it's a very hard problem to figure out what you do with North Korea, but I agree with Dr. Hecker that the context is focus on the plutonium and focus on the six-party talks.
So with regard to both the Iran and North Korea situations, do you both have a single step that you would think would best advance the cause of restraining the movement of those two countries towards an active nuclear weapons program?
I think this is an area in which we need to continue the president's strategy of internationalizing it. I think that it is, we need to keep working as we are working on making it clear to both of those states that they can't play off one part of the international community against another. The problem with that prescription is that it means that we are, to some extent, hostage to our international allies and partners. But you know, we work this. The Russians have a mixed record on Iran, but some of what they've done has been quite helpful. The Chinese are clearly key to any solution involving North Korea, and they are speaking of the importance of being seen as a responsible international actor. And this is a wonderful opportunity for them to make themselves one.
Just to complete our rogues gallery here, so to speak, does the current situation in the Middle East worry you at all in light of Israel's nuclear capabilities?
Well, the current situation in the Middle East ought to worry everybody. Just in whether nuclear weapons had ever been invented, the current situation in the Middle East is worrisome. I don't see at the moment that it's that it's got any unique nuclear dimensions. But any time you have hundreds of people being killed in violence that may well be inspired, back to our friends Iran, inspired, tolerated, encouraged, you pick your word, but Hezbollah is widely believed to be closely associated with Iran. I think you have to worry. I think you have to worry about the apparent lack of control of the Palestinian Authority over their various security organs. I think you have to worry about how we're back to a world in which we're doing incursions into Lebanon. I think it's a very important international security problem. I'm not sure that I see that it has any unique nuclear dimensions.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd really like to continue this discussion given the many good questions we still have. So I'd like to give our thanks to Ambassador Linton Brooks, Administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration, not only for your comments today, but for your work in this very important area.
Thank you. May I make one last thank you back?
Of course. And I'd like to thank Sig Hecker, too, when we get back to that.
Read your quote. The success of any democratic society rests heavily on the enthusiasm and understanding with which its members participate in civic life. If you want to see the source of that quote, you can walk out in your library because it's from the telegram that President Carter sent congratulating the Commonwealth Club on the 75th anniversary, almost 30 years ago. And for those of us in government, the knowledge that there are people who will come out and sit in a hot room to try and understand important issues is hugely important. Whether you agree with anything I've said or everything I've said, it is one of the reasons why I'm so proud to be in government service, that there are people who do this. And so I appreciate being here, but I also want to thank you for your interest in these kind of issues.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks. Mr. Brooks, thank you also to Sig Hecker for being with us. Thank you all for coming this evening and doing exactly what Mr. Brooks said. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.